from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Publish or perish goes the old ivory tower mantra, but once it is published, research is often owned and controlled by a handful of private companies. Now, the University of California is saying enough is enough, calling on companies to make the newest studies more readily available to all. It's part of a growing trend toward more openness in science and publishing. But the industry says their subscription business model is popular with authors who prefer to publish in well-known and well-respected journals. We'll take up the debate after the news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. The University of California, which publishes about 10% of the country's scientific research, paid more than $10 million in 2018 to access and publish its own research in scientific journals owned by the publisher Elsevier. Now, UC is taking the lead on a push for open access content, which would make publicly funded research free and immediately accessible to the public. This hour, we're going to discuss what the conflict between UC and Elsevier reveals about the scientific publishing industry and changes that may be on the horizon. Joining us in studio here is Randy Scheckman. He's professor of molecular and cell biology at the University of California, Berkeley, winner of the 2013 Nobel Prize in Medicine. Good to have you with us. Welcome.
Thank you.
Also want to welcome Jeff Mackey Mason. He is University of librarian at the University of California, Berkeley, and a professor in the School of Information and the Department of Economics. He co-chairs UC's Publisher Negotiation Task Force. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Michael.
Good to have you as well. And good to have Rick Anderson with us by phone. He joins us. He's Associate Dean for Collections and Scholarly Communication, University of Utah Library, author of a book called Scholarly Communication, What Everyone Needs to Know. And he's on the advisory board of Elsevier. And welcome to the program, Rick Anderson.
Great to be with you.
Good to have you all aboard here. And Randy Scheckman, let me begin with you. You and Jeff here have been trying to fix this for 25 years. What is it you're exactly trying to fix? And what is open access? What
does
that mean?
Sure. Well, open access is the idea that the scientific literature, which was paid for largely by public funds, public taxpayer funds, should be available for all, not only those who are in universities and who have access to scientific journals, but also to interested people in the public. Very often, for instance, physicians who are not connected to an institution that may have a site license for scientific literature will not have the ability to read a paper on a subject of direct relevance to their clinical practice. They'll find that if they go to a journal, one of the Elsevier journals or journals owned and published by Springer Nature, they'll have to pay a fee of some $30 or more just for the privilege of reading a paper.
I think the average cost is $40, so you get a paywall right away.
Yeah, probably. And this is largely work that has been funded by, in the case of the U.S., by the NIH, that is by taxpayer funds. So those of us who are associated with the open access movement, and I'm a journal editor of an open access journal, feel very strongly that this is, it's about time that people have access to the literature that they paid for.
Pay to publish, pay to read, and public dollars are what you're...
public dollars. It's also, in this case, this specific case, as Jeff and I will discuss, a question of the absolute amount of the contract that Elsevier has required that the university sign, and that is the most serious issue that we should really discuss today.
Well, let's talk about that. Let's talk about the contract, though, in general with you, Jeff. I mean, we passed the deadline. There was supposed to be a renewal of this contract, I believe, December 31st, and now it's, extended?
Not quite, but basically right, Michael. The contract we had was a five-year contract. It expired on December 31st. We do not have a contract with Elsevier at the moment. They agreed to extend access without a contract for 1 month while we continue negotiations.
By the way, we invited them on this morning. They declined, I should mention. Yeah.
Okay.
Sorry.
We are in continuing negotiations in good faith. We're trying to reach an agreement, but at the moment we are negotiating without a contract for access, but they're providing access through the month of January.
Pretty far apart, though, aren't you?
I would say so, yes. We're quite far apart.
So what is it that you want as opposed to the contract that you had?
Well, because we're in negotiations, I can only talk in general terms about it, but we've made public what our main goals are, and there are two of them. One of them, as Randy discussed, is what we call default open access for all publications by UC authors, University of California authors. And by default, we mean that unless the author objects and chooses not to publish open access, their research will be available to the entire world for free. We'll still pay Elsevier money to publish it, but nobody will have to pay to read. We offer authors the option in the proposal we've made to opt out of that if for some reason they don't want their work to be open access. We're not forcing them to do anything, but we want the default to be that all of the research, which has largely been paid for by public dollars, be available to the public in the U.S. and everywhere in the world. The second thing is that Elsevier is a for-profit company. It has one of the highest profit margins of any company in the world. On its journals, its profit margin is about 43%. Just as a quick point of comparison, last year Apple's profit margin was only 22%, and after yesterday's news, apparently somewhat lower. So Elsevier is getting an enormous amount of profit out of what they're charging us to read the articles that, to a large extent, we wrote. And we would like to see lower prices as well.
Let me go to you on that, Kirk Anderson. Rick Anderson, excuse me. I'd like to get your response to the fact that there are these huge profit margins, and this is really public money that's charging fees.
Yeah. So one thing I should clarify up front is, while I do serve on Elsevier's advisory board, I am not representing Elsevier in any way, and not advocating for Elsevier. I serve on 9 advisory boards currently, some of which are advisory boards of publishers that compete with Elsevier. So I just wanted that to be clear. That being said, I think it's not actually true that Elsevier's journal division achieves 43% profit margins. I'm not at liberty to share all of the data that I have, but and I think it's unfortunate that when you invited Elsevier to come, they declined. Because I think that they would be able to clarify that while the company's overall profit margins are somewhere north of 40%, the profitability of its journals division is dramatically lower than that. But as far as the question of public money, the reality is a little more complicated. What public money pays for is for the research to be conducted. The gap then comes between what happens after the research has been done and then a publishable article is prepared by the publisher. The difficult question is, after the research has been done and the manuscript has been submitted and peer-reviewed and edited and copy-edited and typeset and all the other things that publishers do to turn a manuscript into an article, does the value added by those processes justify the prices charged for access to the final article? Reasonable people can disagree on the degree to which those charges are justified, and the degree to which they're justified will depend in part by how much is charged. But it's not as simple as, well, the public has paid for the research, so the public ought to have access to the research. Access to the research that isn't really a... It's not the research. What you're getting access to is a product that is created after the research is done, and that's where sort of the controversial gap is.
There's another controversial gap. I was reading some statements by a professor of economics at UCSB, University of California, Santa Barbara, by the name of Ted Bergstrom, and he says he describes it as what Elsevier is doing essentially is a little bit of editing and putting the papers online, and that's about it.
Yeah, that's the kind of thing that people say who have never done publishing. the reality is that publishers do an awful lot more than just, you know, a little bit of editing and then putting the articles online. The peer review process is very involved and expensive to manage. The rejection of papers is an expensive process that the cost of which can't be recouped by selling access to accepted papers. There's a big difference between editing and copy editing. Managing the submission process itself, monitoring for plagiarism, archiving and curating the published content, which is a relatively new role that publishers have really only begun to fulfill since the advent of the World Wide Web. Managing compliance with funder requirements, applying and managing metadata, these are all things that publishers do that add value to manuscripts.
But you mentioned the digital age. You're kind of a relic of the print era in many ways. I mean, the certainly the business plan is a relic of the print era, isn't it?
In some ways, yeah. I mean, certainly the publishers are still doing all of the things that they used to do during the print era, and as well as all of the new things that are now required by the digital environment.
Let me go back, Randy Shechtman, to you. You're kind of making some gestures here mm-hmm. that are striking to me as an observer. Mm-hmm. You want to at least vocalize them?
Sure, sure. Well, I certainly agree with what Rick said. There are legitimate expenses, even if a journal is purely online. All the things that he said are done by all journals, not just the Elsevier journals. All journals, including the Elsevier journals, rely to a large extent on free labor provided by academics who do most of the reviewing for the journals as part of their academic responsibility. So the question is not, are there other legitimate expenses? Absolutely, there are other legitimate expenses, but other journals find other ways to publish without the very large profit margin that Elsevier enjoys. Let me give you an example from my own experience. I'm a journal editor of an open access online journal, but before that I was the editor of a very important journal published by the U.S. National Academy of Sciences. That journal has by charter a mandate to break even. They cannot be a burden on the National Academy, nor can they generate a profit. And they've done so for over 100 years, doing all the things that Rick has indicated journals do. Nonetheless, their license with the UC Digital Library amounted in recent contract to about $25,000 a year compared to the $11 million a year that the Elsevier journals have charged the university in their contract. Of course, that's a false comparison because...
Oh, because Elsevier is for profit.
Well, no, not only that, to be fair to them, they publish many journals, hundreds, probably thousands of journals. So the comparison is between one journal, a very prominent journal, the organ of the National Academy, and the bundle of journals that are required by contract to be in the arrangement with the University of California. Nonetheless, it's interesting to note that you can break it down and compare the two by looking at the number of times the journal of the National Academy is accessed online versus the number of times the bundle of Elsevier journals is accessed by University of California licensees. And you can then rate the amount of money per download for the Journal of the National Academy versus the Elsevier journals. And the figures that I've obtained that are public information are that for UC, they pay 4 cents per download for articles in the National Academy journal. For Elsevier journals, they pay $1.06 per download for all of those journals. So that is the profit margin we're talking about that is many of us consider excessive.
Well, when I mentioned them being for profit, I think we also have to add into that the fact that I think this is something that you've called our attention to, Randy Shechtman, that you've got essentially... For the most part, these journals, there are many of them, as you said, but for the most part, they're non-academic people who are running them. They're people who are
yes.
in the business of making profits. And
yes.
In fact, is there an example in Lancet, the medical journal, publishing an anti-vaccination article
no.
to kind of stir up more
Right. No, that
purchases?
Was that was a disaster published in 1998, where the claim was made that there might be a link between triple vaccination against childhood diseases and the subsequent development of autism. That was published, but only eventually retracted by Lancet, one of the Elsevier journals, 12 years after it was published.
Do you have a take on that, Rick Anderson? I think, the Lancet publication or what we're talking about here?
That kind of... So the first question you were talking about was basically a pricing question.
Yeah.
And as Randy pointed out, what he was comparing was $125,000 journal as compared to a $2,500 journal package from Elsevier. But that cost per download, of course, is a very striking difference, and it goes to the question of price. You know, are Elsevier journals worth what they cost? And that's a completely legitimate question that every subscriber to Elsevier journals has to ask him or herself, and every library has to ask itself as it considers renewing. The UC system, like many libraries right now, has what's colloquially called a big deal package, or Elsevier calls it, unfortunately, the Freedom Collection, which I think is a terrible brand, but it's basically access to their entire journal list at a, you know, a deeply discounted per unit price, but of course a very high cost for the whole package. Nobody is required to subscribe to the big deal. Elsevier continues to sell individual subscriptions to any individual or library who wants them. But that big deal package became very popular in the early 2000s, and it really, when libraries take advantage of that package, it really puts them kind of in a bind. You know, on the one hand, we're getting arguably a great deal on a per-unit basis for these journals. On the other hand, it's tying up very large amounts of our budget, and amounts of our budget that grow every year as we renew. So, you know, the fact that UC is in tough negotiations with Elsevier right now over the terms of their big deal renewal is, you know, they're doing what libraries as consumers in the scholarly communication ecosystem ought to do, and that is negotiate hard with the people from whom they're buying goods and services.
Well, let's talk about those negotiations. And Jeff Mackey Mason, I mean, I'm wondering about the clout you have and the leverage you have in the midst of these negotiations. That's the big question, usually, when you're talking about negotiations on this level.
Of course, the question is who has more power at the table. And we're in the process of finding that out, frankly. We're in the middle of negotiations.
You could make a deal that would not necessarily redound to your advantage, though, too. I mean, there's always that possibility, isn't it?
Well, historically, Elsevier, as Rick said, has been, and many publishers, most publishers, have been raising prices quite substantially at above the rate of general inflation, which has been really devastating to budgets. University budgets have been declining over the past 15 years, university library budgets declining even faster, and the publishers have been raising prices faster than inflation. But we think that we have a substantial position. First of all, the University of California, as you mentioned at the outset, is responsible for nearly 10% of the output of U.S. scholarship, less a fraction of the world, but it's a very large fraction of U.S. scholarship. And we're not the only ones negotiating with Elsevier in this fashion. The entire nation of Germany has canceled its contract with Elsevier first through a consortium called Project Deal 2 years ago. They canceled their contract for most universities.
And then there was the Max Planck Society recently.
Just last 2 weeks ago, the Max Planck Society, which is basically all of the other researchers in Germany, also canceled their contract.
And Sweden has as well, I think.
That's right. Last spring, the nation of Sweden also canceled. They have a consortium. They canceled. The nation of Hungary just canceled their contract. Florida State canceled their contract last year. So there's a lot of pressure, and we think that the leverage is growing, largely because the economics don't make sense anymore. I'm sorry to disagree with Rick, but Elsevier's profit on its journals is actually higher than on the rest of its business. I have been in close contact with investment bank analysts in Europe and have seen their analyses, and 43% is pretty consistent. 41 to 43% over the past decade is the profit rate, which is enormous on journals.
Jeff, that's even bigger than most corporations, as you said before, not only Apple, but by the majority of corporations. I want to read you a statement from Elsevier. We invited them and they declined, but get your response to this. Elsevier supports open access and a more inclusive, collaborative, and transparent world of research through open science. Elsevier is also strongly supportive of our authors having options to publish their work for free, as around 85% of them currently prefer, or to choose to have to pay a fee to publish. We serve the needs of customers and researchers around the globe, so we have to be careful about uprooting the way most researchers prefer to publish for free in well-regarded journals.
Well, that's a standard statement of theirs, and I think there are a couple of serious problems with it. First of all, they say that they support open access and welcome it. It is true that you can publish material open access in most Elsevier journals, but you have to pay an additional fee on top of the subscription. It's what we call double dipping. We pay the subscription to Elsevier, and then if our authors want their articles to be open access, they have to pay money on top of that, a second fee on top of that. Of course, if you ask anybody, do you want to publish for free, who's going to say no? If they have the option of publishing for free, everybody would rather use their research funds for something else. So that's sort of a silly statement. If the funds were currently used for subscriptions, were being used instead for publication, Elsevier could make just as much money and be paid just as much to publish, but then make the material free to the world. I want to be clear about this. We are not talking about not paying the publisher to do its job. As Randy said, as Rick said, as I'll say, publishers do important work, and they need to be paid.
Let me cut to the chase, though, for a moment with Rick Anderson again. Rick Anderson, what would be lost if a publisher like Elsevier didn't exist?
If there were no publishers like Elsevier, or if Elsevier itself—
let's talk about Elsevier specifically, because it's the biggest globally.
Its journals would be picked up by other commercial publishers probably, and we'd end up probably paying just as much to Springer or Taylor and Francis or Sage or Wiley for those journals as we do to Elsevier. Maybe some of them would go back to being or those that used to be independently published journals by society publishers might go back to that model, and then they would probably charge lower prices. I mean, one thing that's really important to understand is that the big five commercial publishers are dramatic outliers in the scholarly communication publishing industry. There's somewhere in the neighborhood of 10,000 publishers in the world right now publishing scholarly journals, somewhere north of 60,000 journals in total. Elsevier, Wiley, Sage, Taylor & Francis, Springer are five of those 10,000 journals. They collectively publish between 10 and 15,000 of those 60,000 journals. So it's certainly a disproportionately high number of journals that they control. But they are not typical scholarly publishers. And one of the things that concerns me is when I hear people using the word publisher when what they really mean is Elsevier or Wiley, and when we talk about changing the publishing environment in ways that are designed to undermine Elsevier's profitability, that are going to have unintended consequences for the thousands of small nonprofit publishers that are sort of just trying to get by and benefit their members.
Well, as long as you're talking about consequences, at the present we have no more access to new articles for about 69,000 faculty and about 238,000 students in the UC system until this is negotiated through or brought to some sort of fruition. And I'm going to invite our listeners to join us and on our way in here, let us know your thoughts, let us know your concerns, and also let us know any questions you might have. You can join us toll-free. The number to call, 866-733-6786. We welcome your call, so please feel free to be part of the program. Again, you can join us live at that toll-free number, 866-733-6786. You can also email us, and we welcome your emails, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website and post any questions or comments there at kqed.org/forum. Simply click on the segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. A couple comments coming in. Gabby says, why doesn't UC create their own journal? I would totally read it for fun. And Elizabeth says, my concern is the public having access to correct and well-researched information instead of false conclusions. In an age of fake news, people will more likely believe something in a bogus journal if they don't have access to tested information. You can let us know your thoughts. We welcome them. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny, and University of California, all campuses are taking on the publishing conglomerate, actually fighting for open access to publicly funded research. And a couple of those warriors are here with us in studio. They've been at it for a quarter of a century. Randy Sheckman, who's professor of molecular and cell biology at UC Berkeley, also winner of the 2013 Nobel Prize in Medicine. And Randy, you know what my idol Sal Bellow said about winning a Nobel Prize? The only thing wrong with it? Can only get it once.
No, that's not true. Marie Curie won it twice.
Did she? there is a precedent then. Jeff Mackey Mason, also with us, university librarian, the University of California, Berkeley, professor in the School of Information and the Department of Economics, and co-chair of UC's Publisher Negotiation Task Force. Rick Anderson with us as well by phone, associate dean for Collections and Scholarly Communication at the University of Utah Library, author of a book called Scholarly Communication, What Everyone Needs to Know. And he's on the advisory board of Elsevier, the biggest publishing company that is still negotiating with the UCs. If you are a researcher or if you have published or are an academic, you may want to weigh in here. Let us know your experience with publishing your work. And again, you can get in touch with us by going to Twitter or Facebook or email us, KQED Forum, or actually post them on our website, questions you might have at kqed.org. Let me go to a caller here from Sebastopol. James, join us. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Sure. I'm a biologist, and I've published in a journal, and I've done my due diligence and done peer reviews as well. And I'm in full support of open access. I think that would be great. I would love to not have to pay for these fantastic research journal articles. But I think the issue is how do you get scientists to want to publish in an alternative journal, say an open access journal, because it seems like there's a big incentive to further your career by getting published in one of these really big name journals.
Excellent question, Randy Shekman.
Yeah, this is something that I fight constantly. I started a new open access online journal called eLife, whose premise is precisely that issue that this gentleman raises. There is an enormous pressure on young scholars to publish in a very small number of venues, one of which is the journal Nature, published by Springer Nature, and then in the life sciences, a very important one is a journal called Cell that's published by Elsevier. These journals have branded themselves very effectively. They are highly selective. They, in the case of Nature, publish only 8% of the submissions that are sent in for review, and they do so to cultivate a sense of exclusivity. A sense of exclusivity that I have, I've been very concerned, may lead some people to misrepresent their work, to create a sensational story where none exists. And that has had tragic consequences. One of them was studied by the biotech company Amgen in Southern California, who some years ago found that the major discoveries that were published relevant to cancer chemotherapeutic drug discovery could not be reproduced. 85% of the experiments that might have led to new drugs could not be reproduced. Almost all of these papers were published in the very high-profile journals that this fellow mentions.
You think about the poor countries here that just don't have access or can't have access, can't afford, and so forth, and the possibility of their gaining knowledge that could really be very useful in research.
Yeah, well, it's not just that, but it's also very, very well-developed countries. In China, for instance, there's such tremendous pressure to publish in these journals that people are paid cash bribes just for winning the lottery and being able to publish in a journal like Cell.
Yeah, you want to say something here, Jeff?
Yeah, Michael, thanks. There's both the being able to publish and there's being able to read. And you mentioned poor countries. I just wanted to make the point that there's been a fair bit of attention to the Global South not being able to afford the subscriptions of scholarly science, and they can't get access to science to do their own science. But the Global South includes most universities in the U.S. in this regard in the following way. There is not a single university in the U.S., and that includes Harvard, and it includes the University of California, not a single university that can subscribe to all scholarly journals. It just costs too much. And when you look at the mid-sized universities or the liberal arts colleges, they can subscribe to only a small fraction of the research being produced. So that's why we think it's not just a Global South problem. It's not just the uneducated or the non-scientific public. They're, of course, educated. I meant the non-scientific public. But even our scientists can't get access to most research because of the paywall established in front of it.
Wasn't something done differently at MIT? Haven't they set up something different?
You may be referring to their recent license with the Royal Society of Chemistry.
Yes.
Yeah, that's one contract that MIT entered with the Royal Society of Chemistry that is the type of contract we're talking about. They're paying to publish, and then the articles that the MIT scholars publish in the Royal Society of Chemistry journals are free to the world. So that's one example. Iowa State University just announced yesterday that they have entered a similar contract with another publisher called De Gruyter. The same thing, what we call a publish and read contract, where they pay a single price so that all of the articles published by their scholars are freely available to the world and the publisher gets paid to publish them. And everything else, the Iowa State or MIT faculty get to read because they're also paying a reading fee. But it caps the total payment to the publishers. The publisher gets the money it needs to run its business plus its profit margin, but it doesn't get to double dip.
I want to go to another caller, but first, let me go back to you, if I may, Rick Anderson, and get a response to a caller, a listener named Jeffrey, who writes, I'm a professor at UC, but just this morning I used the illegal Sci-Hub to access an important research paper related to my work because UC doesn't have a license for the journal in question.
So what's your question?
Well, that's embedded in the caveats you've been bringing to our attention, isn't it?
Well, Sci-Hub is basically an international crime syndicate that has created a massive copyright piracy operation by which they take articles out from behind paywalls and make them freely available. They also the primary way in which they do this is by getting network authentication data from professors and students. It's not clear how often that information is given willingly and how often it's a result of phishing or other sorts of nefarious techniques, but Sci-Hub is there. It is what it is, and people can use it to get illegal free access to copyrighted material. How bad a thing like Sci-Hub is going, or how bad you see something like Sci-Hub is going to depend on the degree to which you see commercial publishing as a legitimate thing to do, the degree to which you see copyright as something that deserves to be protected. There are a lot of widely varying opinions as to the appropriateness and goodness or badness of Sci-Hub.
Let me bring another caller aboard here. Michael, join us. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Thank you for taking my call. And just kind of extending this idea of the pay barrier or the cost barrier. So if I find a non-profit, a public benefit, a research and policy diplomatization,
Michael, your call's breaking up. I'm sorry. We're going to have to let you go and hope you can call us back. But a question for you, Professor Mackie Mason. Janet wants to know, can you explain how publishers would earn money to pay their costs under an open access system?
Sure. There are a variety of ways. As we've said, we're not saying that publishers should work for free. Of course not. The types of contracts the University of California is currently negotiating, not just with Elsevier, but with several other publishers, by the way, are what we have referred to as publish and read. We would pay them a total amount of money, let's say for approximation purposes, the same amount of money we're paying today, but that would cover the publishing of the articles by UC authors and the reading of articles by other people. So Elsevier or the other publishers would get the same amount of money they're getting today, approximately. We're, of course, negotiating over price, but for the purpose of open access, they get the same amount of money, so they'd still be able to run their business. But instead of paying to read, which creates a paywall that blocks access to scientific research, we would instead be paying to publish. And if all universities and research centers entered such contracts, then the publishers would get their money to publish, but the entire world would be able to read.
Let me bring another voice into this. Allison Muddett is chief executive officer of PLOS, the Public Library of Science. They're a San Francisco-based nonprofit. And Allison Muddett, good to have you with us.
Thanks, Michael. Good to join you.
Yeah, thank you for joining us. Let's talk with you first about Plan S, which I know you're involved in. This is a kind of European version of open access. It's almost, tell us about it.
So Plan S is a recent initiative from a group of funders, initially all based in Europe, but now including some large funders from outside Europe, including the Gates Foundation, who joined this initiative back in November. And their real focus is on trying to ensure that the resulting papers from the research they fund will be available free to read immediately on publication. They account for a significant amount of research funding. I think it's about 7.5 billion euros at this point in time. That's still a relatively small percentage of total research funding. But the key thing, there are a couple of other tweaks to this initiative that have really caused some concern among certain publishers. A key one is that they are planning to cap the amount that they are willing to pay for open access publishing and to put certain stipulations on the type of open access that will be acceptable. That said, it's been welcomed by many of us as a real opportunity to move open access forward at a time when it feels that it has got a little stuck. And so alongside the kind of stance that the UC is taking in negotiation, it's a real opportunity to drive a much more significant transformation in the way in which research is shared.
And the gold standard in many people's minds now is the Gates Foundation and how they're doing things. You call this open science, I believe, more than open access, don't you?
That's right. At this point in time, we are looking towards a future where there are much more transparent ways of discussing and assessing work over the entire lifetime of research, and looking beyond just free and unrestricted access to the articles, but also thinking about the underlying data, code that might be involved, transparency across how articles are reviewed, and a much more open approach to how science is assessed.
So how does peer review work in this?
Peer review is still the foundation of all scientific publishing, and I think one of the key things that I'd like to stress here is that open access content is peer reviewed in just the same way as content that appears in subscription journals. That's often a criticism of open access, but it is in fact false, and we peer review journals in just the same way as subscription publishers.
So PLOS is pushing for change. Aren't you also allied with Stanford and the National Cancer Institute?
No, we are actually one of our founders. We were founded by three eminent scientists back in 2000, and one of our founders, Pat Brown, was based at Stanford at the time.
Okay, well, I appreciate very much your being with us and letting us know your perspective, which is different than the UC perspective, I think is safe to say.
I wouldn't say entirely. I think we're very allied with the same goals that the University of California has. PLOS is a slightly different publisher in that we are a pure open access publisher, and that's all we do. So our business model is one that is based purely on making sure that everything we publish is available free to everyone immediately on publication. In that sense, I think our values are very much allied with the goals of the UC.
Well, we thank you again for joining us. That's Allison Muddit. She's Chief Executive Officer of the Public Library of Science. They are a San Francisco-based nonprofit. And let me read some comments that are coming in. Mark says, it's important also to understand that open access publishing is typically very expensive. Requirements, for example, to publish open access can effectively result in suppressing science simply by raising the cost of publication. Randy Shechtman?
Well, I'm not sure I agree with that. We have the journal eLife, which is an open access, completely open access, gold standard model. The fee that we charge is $2,500 for publishing an article. That's pretty much the average for all journals if you add in all the costs. The journal of the National Academy that I referred to earlier called the Proceedings has a cost of something like $1,700 for an article, but they have, in addition to that, a cost of nearly $1,500 if you wish to have that open access. So the sum of those two is exactly what we charge. It's really not that different.
And a tweet from Kenny, if I go to you, Jeff, he wants to know, does free and open information material inspire donors?
We find it does. We've actually got a very active program at the Berkeley Library supported by donors to advance our scholarly communication efforts, which includes open access. It also includes open educational resources for our students to lower the cost of education. Different topic, but donors have been quite enthusiastic about this because they want to see science advance the world and see everybody have access to it, particularly those who are less advantaged than the most well-funded universities.
Works and pledge drives, too, generally. We get the support. Rahel joins us next. Rahel, welcome.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, ma'am. Can't hear you.
Okay. So I have a question as to whether open access would allow people like myself to have free access to research. I'm a physician. I've been in physician and solo practice for well over 20 years, so I'm not associated with any institution that would give me access to research articles. And that has been very important part of my clinical practice. Each time I want to read an actual article costs about $30 or $35, which makes it really completely unaffordable. So that will be a very important thing for practicing clinicians who need to stay up to date with current clinical research or basic science research. And at this point, it's something that's really not affordable to people who are not associated with an institution that can give them a license to access latest research.
That's an important question. And let me go to you on this, Rick Anderson. Would open access mean really open access to non-academics and people outside the university world?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, if a journal article is made available on an open access basis, that means anybody in the world with internet access can read it. And then depending on what flavor of open access, because there are multiple definitions, some of which are in competition with each other, it may also mean that they can reuse the content of the article in any way they want. It depends on what kind of license is applied to it.
Yeah, well, thank you for that response, Rahel. I wanted to follow it up with another question from a listener named Mike, to you again, Rick. Mike says authors should retain copyright so they can publish in more than one journal and create inter-journal competition, thereby forcing prices down.
Well, yeah, and certainly that's a point of negotiation that authors can enter into with publishers if they want. Typically, journal publishers, scholarly journal publishers, typically do require copyright assignment, basically in return for the publishing service that they're giving the author. Whether that is a fair exchange is a very controversial question, with people sort of adamant on both sides of it. The whole competitive dynamic between journals is a very interesting one, because copyright in and of itself is essentially a monopoly right. If you are the author of an article, you are the only person who has the legal right to decide where it may and may not be published. And then if you transfer your copyright to another entity, then that other entity is then has the sole right to decide where and how to publish it. One of the common features of open access is the application of what's called a Creative Commons license, which I think Randy may have mentioned earlier. And a license like that sort of gives to the public some or all of what would normally be the exclusive prerogatives of the copyright holder. But the degree to which authors are in a position to keep their copyright, you know, really depends on what the publisher they're dealing with wants, what they want from the publisher, and what they're able to negotiate. But in reality, very, very often the author does sort of have a choice between publishing with that publisher or keeping the copyright and doing something else. Sometimes you can negotiate the retention of your copyright, and sometimes you can't.
Let me read, in the meantime, before I go to more listener calls, a tweet from a listener. This is a mother's perspective. She writes, "I'm a PhD biochemist currently taking time off to raise my child, but I can't stay current with my field because of paywalls, another way that mothers are disadvantaged in academia." Let me go to more of your phone calls, and let's go next to a caller from Berkeley. David, that's you. Good morning.
Hi. Good morning. I find this discussion a bit confounding. I'm a reporter, and in pursuit of medical information, I accessed many journals. And a few years ago, I found that many of the articles that interested me were no longer free. It was 30-some bucks for almost every one. Are you saying that our tax dollars pay for the research that we are only allowed to see for a payment in addition to our taxes that funded the research? And then I believe I heard one of your guests say the journal article isn't the research, it's the product of the research, and we have to pay again? Your discussion, I think, is straying from the issue. Very simply, if the public funds it, the public should have access, period. The public is paying, and you're getting them coming and going.
That is the position of both of my studio guests, I believe. Rick Anderson, you would say what?
Well, I would say if I'm a researcher and I get a $1 million grant and I do $1 million worth of research, the money from that grant has gone to the performance of the research. That money did not include all of the cost of turning a write-up of that research into a peer-reviewed, edited, you know, typeset, yada, 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 all the things that publishers do, article. We can lament that if we want, but if I have a dollar, I can either spend a dollar on thing A, or I can spend a dollar on thing B, or I can spend 50 cents on thing A and 50 cents on thing B. But what I can't do is spend the same dollar on both thing A and thing B. Research in this metaphor is thing A, and the process of turning an author's manuscript into a published article is thing B. You know, the money has to come from somewhere. If all of the research funding was spent doing the research, then the money to turn that article into, or to turn the manuscript into an article, has to come from someplace else.
What about that argument? Let me go either to Randy or Jeff on this. I mean, that the money definitely has to come from somewhere for the typesetting and all the rest of it. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, this is Jeff. I'll say that the first of all, most of the money for subscriptions is also coming from the public. My budget at the university library, which pays for the subscriptions for Berkeley, is public money. It's either coming from government sources or it's coming from tuition, which is relatively low in California, but in any case is money used to support education. So the money is there. We're already spending the money. The publishers are in business. It's really just a question of whether or not they get the money out of public hands in order to pay to read, which creates a paywall and blocks the callers you've been hearing from having access, or they get the money to publish. Money is there. We're paying them right now. It's just we have to pay them in a different way.
And the grant money is taxpayer money, too.
Yes.
Let me read some comments. Gabriel writes, I'm a publisher. Digital transformation costs nearly nothing. An accepted article is already in digital form. It must only be digitally copied and formatted to be published. Peer review is free. Rick Anderson?
You know, again, those are the kinds of things said only by people who have never done that work. Digital transformation is tremendously expensive. Peer review is tremendously expensive. You know, Randy and Jeff and I all agree on the real costs that are involved in these processes. The controversy that's going on right now is about what is the best way to cover those costs. And, you know, reasonable, well-informed people operating in good faith have very different views, diverging views on what's the best way to allocate money and where it should come from. And, you know, should the paywall be imposed between the content and the reader, or should the paywall be imposed between the researcher and the publishing service, or should the journal be entirely subsidized by an institution? You know, there's any number of different ways that these costs can be covered, but what can't be done is the costs can't be wished away.
Let me bring
saying digital transformation is free and peer review is free, unfortunately, doesn't make either of those things free.
Yeah, I want to get some more callers on board here, but let me just read a few more comments that are coming in. Mark tweets, I've been hearing that the complications and costs of publishing cause science to stall and perverts the information we get from peer-reviewed journals. Also, isn't rejection of this system what sprung Wikipedia to the top? Nicole says, why don't UC and CSU join forces and start their own journal suite? They have more than enough of content to be selective, and it would become well-respected before long. We've been hearing that recommendation a few people have made. Robert asks, for fun, can Randy Shechtman comment on the greatest benefit of all for a Nobel Prize winner at UC Berkeley, namely a reserve-free parking space? All right, I'm going to get some more calls here. You don't have to comment on that, Randy, unless you want to. Here's a Sausalito caller. Nate, you're on. Morning.
Hi. So I'm a researcher with the University of California in the astronomy department, and in physics and astronomy, the culture is that we always post our articles freely on a site called the Archive, ARXIV. But I wanted to comment that when I'm interested in reading research in other fields, I find it very strange that there's a paywall, because in my field, I've never experienced that whatsoever. I'd be interested for you to comment on that cultural difference.
Yeah, Randy has a comment. Thank you.
Yeah, the Physics Archive is a wonderful resource for the physics community that's been in existence for over 30 years. But I should point out that 80% of the papers that are posted on the Physics Archive are eventually then published in a regular journal, because there is tremendous value added by the reviewing process. The imprimatur of a journal stamped on a paper, having been reviewed largely by anonymous peer review, adds real significance to the findings. And that is not although the Physics Archive and more recently now the Biology Archive are tremendous resources, they have not yet replaced publication.
Another caller joining us from Oakland. Dan, you're on. Thanks for waiting.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'm a researcher in the UC system, and I will agree with your guest that there is a lot of effort that goes into the preparation of manuscripts, the copy editing, as well as the peer review, and that effort is done almost entirely by graduate students. We have requirements down to the exact file format and pixel size of the figures that we put in articles. We're often asked to do the peer review, and all of this is without any sort of compensation. So I find it a bit specious that your guest argues the profit margins incurred by journals are justified by the efforts done by people outside of those journals. And I'll take my comments off the air.
All right, a comment from you, Rick Anderson, please.
I'm not necessarily saying anybody's profit margins are justified. What I'm saying is the costs are real. Certainly, it's true that a lot of work that goes into the preparation of manuscripts is, in fact, done by, I wouldn't use the word volunteers, because those of us who do that kind of work are typically being paid a salary by our universities, but we're certainly not being paid in that work by the publishers. However, it is also true that publishers employ a lot of people to do a lot of additional work. For example, Elsevier, from what I've been told, and has roughly 80,000 editors working on their journals, 20,000 of whom are paid a stipend. The peer reviewing itself is typically done by faculty who are not being paid by the publisher, but managing the peer review process takes a tremendous amount of work and is very expensive to do. Any system looks simpler from the outside than it actually is. And I think that we're seeing that reflected in some of the comments today.
We're going to have to leave it there. Rick Anderson, thank you for joining us. Thanks to Jeff Mackay Mason. Mackay, yeah.
Mackey,
I'm sorry.
That's all right.
And Randy Shekelman, thank you all for being with us this hour of Forum. And thank you, our listeners. We wouldn't be here without you. KQED Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Tina Lauerberg, and Christina Kim. Senior editor is Dan Zoll, and our engineer today is Katie McMurrin. Engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. And we get online support from Amanda Fun. Our interns are Kate Wolf and Josh Coe. Executive editor is Ethan Lindsay. Chief content officer is Harley Kernan. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.